How it plays out, look, I think Gina ends up loving a bid, doesn't she? As a min shareholder, I believe that Chris is very well positioned. He doesn't necessarily need to own all the rock. But I think when we talked about it at Diggers and Dealers was that Spartan was going to get taken over by Westgold. And since then, I spotted Wayne and Simon at the pub at Diggers and I snapped a few photos of them together and started spreading the rumour even more so, mainly amongst my team rather than to the broader market. Well, looking at the combination of all these things, and I'm sitting back from my valuation going, if NAL continues to operate over its life, I do think that Piedmont's probably worth $1.40 and it's trading at 48 cents today. So now, if I think about a company like Datura Royalties, they trade, I think, at EV to EBITDA about 11 times, and Fortescue trades at 5 to 6 times. The most obvious example where I can tell you how much a royalty is worth versus an operating mine, it's worth double what an operating mine is. I was almost obsessed about Syrah in terms of, like, I just love the thematic. I love learning about it. It's another one of those lessons you learn that just because it's a great thematic doesn't mean you'll make money on it.
G'day, Money Miners. Tuesday, October 31st, we have part two of our interview with Anthony Kavanagh of Chester Asset Management, which we're excited to share today, Trev.
How good was part one?
It was awesome. You know, he's got a passionate and global perspective. He obviously looks across the range of equities, not just Materis. That's a bit different to some of the other investors that we might chat with. So I'm pretty keen to share this one and get into all the specific stocks that people want to hear about, mate.
Mate, super, super pumped. This is a broad-ranging conversation. I love the chat about lithium consolidation. I love the chat about, you know, Murchison consolidation. I just love the insight into some stocks that you normally kind of don't even bother doing a deep dive on, like Piedmont.
That's it. If people are wondering, the chat was recorded last week. So, you know, stuff is moving very, very quickly in the world of lithium M&A, as you sort of pick up on, as we talked about in shows later last week. But, you know, the broader themes are what are super, super interesting to see where the big picture is, where is everything going. And, you know, you can sort of take your own insights. I know I took a bunch from this one.
All right, mate, couple of quick things to shout out about. One is that tonight we are going to be at the Criterion Hotel at 6 p.m. in Sydney. So come and join us for a beer. We're keen to meet you, keen to have a beer, keen to talk mining stocks with you all. And the second one is that tickets to our live event go live on Thursday. So just a couple of days' time, those tickets to our live event, which is going to be on the 7th of December at 5 p.m. at Golden West Brewery in Subiaco, they go live this Thursday, the 2nd of November.
That's it. Both going to be a great time.
All right, mate. We've got some wicked sponsors to pump up their tyres. The first one, believe it or not, is the wonderful Terra Capital, who we are having a good old yarn with tomorrow. I'm pretty damn excited for this one. We're gonna have a good chat, some great meal, and hopefully some bloody great beverages. And we're gonna pick their brains because they have massive bloody brains about the world of natural resource investing.
Yeah, Matt, I think we'll be much the wiser after chatting with the team there. They've been sponsoring us, supporting us for a long time. We've done a few chats with a few of them, DK in the past, with Langers as well. They're switched on guys. They're passionate about resources. They're, you know, passionate about growing the investment pool in the resource world as well. So,
you know, it was hilarious. Those guys are getting bloody bang for their buck sponsoring us, because the other day, mate, they messaged Maddie and they were like, can we just give you a buzz about some underground mining? We just need to, and they got some consulting work, pro bono from Maddie to just explain if mining a certain deposit underground would be economic or not. So, mate, bloody bang for their buck.
That Matthew, he talks himself down, but he's a switched on fellow, so there's a thing you can learn.
And we're learning from them, they're learning from us. We're keen to pump them up because they're wicked and we can't wait to have a meal and some drinks with them tomorrow night.
Absolutely, mate. We've also got to thank the guys at K-Drew. So
every time I go to, let's see, Lunch Bar, Q mentions something from the episode before. So, you know, he watches every bloody episode, which is amazing. And almost every second day he asks to meet Ryan O'Sullivan. He's like, I want to meet Ryan O'Sullivan. Because Ryan O'Sullivan is a mysterious character in the mining world who I don't know if people don't know him, they definitely know of him. by virtue of the way that Matt Markle talks about his expert capability extracting rocks out of the ground with his bare hands, blindfolded, encumbered by a whole bunch. Like, he could do it.
He can do it on any terrain as well, anywhere. Terrain. Yeah, the whole works. So
ignore the fact that they are RC drillers.
Yeah, just we'll throw in the real facts in amongst the rambling as well. If you need RC drilling, get in touch with the guys at K-Drill. Ryan O'Sullivan, being the man, he will sort you out. You might have seen, if you follow the resource world, you know the mid cap, the smaller caps, they got their rigs out and about. I've seen them in photos out there recently.
They're out and about. You know what I'm really keen to do, JD, is I really want to throw bags for Ryan. I hear that as a newbie into the drilling world, you got to throw bags, which I think is like the colloquial term for being a driller's offsider.
Yeah,
is that right? Well, yep. I want to throw bags for Ryan.
Bag up the chips, mate.
I'm very keen.
Yeah.
In fact, I reckon it'd be hot competition to throw bags for Ryan O'Sullivan. He's that bloody good, and he's also hot competition to get him on your project. So you bloody call K-Drill.
Yeah.
And beg for Ryan, ask when he's free in the calendar, request him specifically as the guy on the rig, because no one's better than him, but everyone they do hire is expert as well. But I want to throw bags for Ryan on your project.
Yep, get in touch with the reliable team at K-Drill. Thanks heaps, guys. Let's rip part two of our chat with Anthony Kavanagh.
Rip it.
All right, so let's get into stocks specific. And the way I want to go about it is to start by talking about consolidation. So
yeah.
I'm actually going to start with lithium because there's a lot of news come out very recently, and it's quite exciting. And I kind of want to go commodity by commodity, region by region. But I mean, we're not going to be specifically region based for lithium because it's across the whole bloody state in WA. But to start with, you know, Liontown, Kathleen Valley, everything that's gone on the past couple of weeks, what happens there, you know, in 60 seconds, how does that one play out?
I'm not sure if you heard this, but I'd actually heard a month before Albemarle lobbed the bid, Gina and Albemarle were in cahoots and we're going to lob a bid for $3.20 for Liontown. Now, I thought that rumour was interesting enough that I'd heard it, but then when Albemarle went and lobbed a bid alone at $3, it kind of struck me as, was there an agreement between Gina and Albemarle? Did there happen to be some differences in opinion when that agreement was struck and then Albemarle went it alone? And hence Gina was annoyed as to being left out. I don't know, but I thought that's extremely interesting if my mail from a month before our mail lobbed their bid was correct. How it plays out, look, I think Gina ends up lobbing a bid, doesn't she? Like, she's pulling in, my understanding, she's pulling in, I actually won't say the number because someone told me, you know, she's pulling in a lot of money each year. Hancock, I think you guys quoted on their show, how much money do they have?
17 billion?
Yeah, 17 billion. I'm not saying because you've got 17 billion you can afford to be a poor allocator of capital, but I think like...
It's a whole lot cheaper than it was a week ago.
Yeah, it's a whole... You just got to look at like the corporates are buying. So the corporates are all in there. They've all got their foot on different assets. And for one reason or another, the market just doesn't believe it. And it's one of those... It's a really unique situation where the equity market is kind of saying one thing and the corporates are saying another. And I tend to believe that the corporates have a better feel for what's occurring than what the equity market does. Like, these are the guys speaking to the customers in the US and Europe and speaking to the customers in China. I think at the moment the equity market is, and it happens so many times in cyclical markets, the equity market is extrapolating things near the bottom of a cycle or the top of a cycle, and they get so caught up in the here and the now. So, yes, China has seen material decreases in lithium prices. We have seen mark-to-market, you know, earnings downgrades for every single lithium company. And you'll see that again with these quarterlies coming up. Mins will print a number lower than the market. Pilbara will print a number lower than the market. But if you take yourself away from the cyclicality of this seasonality of the Chinese market, I've spoken to enough people in the market and I know that Japan's coming. I know that Korea's coming. I know that Europe are really yet to start firing the gun on, you know, the lithium consolidation play. And I know North America are now throwing billions of dollars with the IRA to actually get the resources. I think we're going to start to see a few more companies start to get picked off. Like today we've got, you know, Azure getting taken over by SQM is my mail at $3.50. Maybe that's the starting gun to a similar situation to what happened in May, where everyone was so bearish about lithium because of the seasonality of what happened. And then June, July, August, they all went up like 30%. Maybe we're at a similar point today in the lithium market. I keep hearing Rio's name getting mentioned, so I think they're around the mark, whether it's Patriot in North America or whether there's some other assets they've got their eye on. I think that's super interesting, whether, you know, Chris does make a move on Wildcat. But I think ultimately in WA, that whole consolidation is going to be super interesting. And as a min shareholder, I believe that Chris is very well positioned. He doesn't necessarily need to own all the rock. I just think he's plotting a situation similar to what he's got at Onslow. Now, this is one of the things about Min's that kind of people aren't appreciating is the fact that at Onslow, he doesn't own 100% of the iron ore in the upstream. He owns 60% of the iron ore, around 60%. But the downstream, he literally controls what they can do with the rock. He literally has the mining services contracts for all of the upstream for that 60%. And then he's got the downstream exposures with his infrastructure charge. And I do feel like the Onslow iron ore joint venture is a really good analog as to what might happen with the lithium play in the gold fields. You think about like Bald Hill and what they've got at Bald Hill, that DMS circuit. And I know a few people have written about it, but you know, Ben Lyons and you guys have spoken about it. I do think they're trying to get their hands on like a central processing hub. This is Min's. And then they want to process the ore for all the guys around them and also do the mining services for each of them. Now, you get the DMS circuit at Bald Hill, you add in a flotation circuit, maybe you've got ore sorting at the front end, and then you're controlling all the rock that's coming into you from that central location and Min's at the centre of it all. You know, they own 20% of Delta now and Chris is chairman, so effectively controls the company. You know, you've got Pioneer Dome owned by Bill Beamer's Develop. You know, Bill kind of owes Chris a favour for handing him control of that company. You've got Baldania, depending on whether Gina or not acquires Liontown around that region as well. And you've got Bald Hill as well. And I just feel like the market might be missing it. I mean, the market still, in my mind, doesn't appreciate how good a deal Onslow is in terms of the infrastructure charge and how it's been structured. But I feel like there's a very similar situation occurring with the Eastern Goldfields Lithium, and Min stands to benefit from the whole situation. I also think Develop is actually really well placed, and we own Develop, as I said earlier. I think that Bill stands to do all the underground work as part of that JV. So I feel like, you know, Develop are basically going to get Mount Marion underground, possibly. I feel that could get announced in the next couple of weeks. And then a lot of those mines are also going to have underground components to it, right? Like, you know, you speak to Bill and you speak to the team out there, and they chose not to go for Liontown underground because it's going to be 4 to 5 million tonnes. But you look at what Mount Marion could actually be, 1 million tonnes. You look at Pioneer Dome, 1 million tonnes. You look at, you know, pick your lithium mine, whether it be Mount Ida, which, you know, now that Chris has got 20% of Delta, maybe they also do, you know, Mount Ida underground. So there's so many opportunities there for Develop. So you can see the situation where Chris has got the processing hub for all this spodumene. He's making, you know, dollars per tonne of each of the ore that gets processed there, and all the mining associated with it and the crushing associated with all these lithium mines. Bill's got the underground work associated with it, and it's kind of this symbiotic relationship between the two and also the owners of the ore, similar to the Onslow JV. So I'm actually really excited. I actually see this real symbiotic relationship developing between Develop and Min's that I think, you know, I would say that as a Develop and a Min shareholder, but I just think that it's going to be super interesting how it plays out. One other thing I'll add to that as well is there could also be something further where it could be a situation where, you know, Chris Ellison is 65. I know a lot of people don't like to give...
Oh, you're going this far.
I know a lot of people don't like to give away their babies, yeah. Maybe there's a situation where Chris has identified Bill as the successor to the throne. Maybe. This is just me speculating. I love to speculate. Maybe he's gone, there's no one else who can run Min's if I'm not here. And maybe, you know, at some point down the track he goes, I need a successor, and maybe that's Bill. And maybe Bill, if you listen to Bill at any point in the last 3 years, the one guy he respects most in the mining market and he'd be trying to emulate is Chris. And we love both of them. We think both of them are good allocators of capital and both get the job done. So I'm not trying to say that Chris is too old. I love Chris. I think he's done an amazing job. It's just often when you find these founder-led businesses, it's a real tough situation to go, what happens when the founder decides they want to retire? Often it's almost the end of that business. You know, it might still operate, but the business in its current form and the culture that's developed will just won't operate because the person who takes over just doesn't have the same charisma, just doesn't have the same, you know, work ethic or drive that other person has. And if you can think of anyone in the market that might be able to replicate what Chris has done, it's almost impossible. He's just a unique enigma and an amazing manager in the mining industry. And I'd say that Bill's maybe one of the only people that comes close, maybe Rowlett at Genesis, but he's obviously focused on gold. So, yeah, maybe this is going a bit too far, but I'm kind of looking at the tea leaves going that could be something that is a really interesting 3 to 5 year view on Minns and develop. And maybe it means that Minns has to almost take over develop to get Bill in the seat because, you know, Bill owns, you know, 30 million developed shares plus his options package. But I'm just looking at it going, it could be a really interesting play, you know, particularly if Wodgina needs to go underground too and more of their mines need, you know, an underground expertise involved.
Yeah, I mean, we did hear Chris say probably 3 or 4 months ago now that there is a plan. He can't reveal it to anyone, but there's a plan.
There's a plan.
I'm not sure that's talking about Bill, but the tie-up of all the lithium assets, there's certainly something in the works there.
And as I said before, I find it really weird that people are still doubting him. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like he's got this amazing track record.
Must be bloody tired after doing what he's done for 30 years.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not trying to say he's tired and he can't keep doing it. I think you speak Chris.
In the sense of having to constantly prove.
Yeah, correct. And I think that's one of those things. And you look at kind of where Minns are at from a balance sheet perspective, and yes, if you believe that they're only going to generate $1.5 billion in EBITDA in 2 to 3 years' time, which some of the bears on the stock suggest, and you've got $3 billion worth of debt, you're at 2x net debt to EBITDA, maybe that's a bit high for a miner. But on our numbers, if you fully load what Onslow can actually deliver using a reasonable assumption around your iron ore price, you fully load where Wodgina can get to, your mining services business doubles because of these internal projects. We generally feel that they can do between $3 and $4 billion when Onslow's fully ramped up, when others in the market have $1.5 to $2 billion. And if that's the case and you've got $3 billion worth of debt now, then you're trading, your net debt to EBITDA is less than 1x. And the other thing as well is that Onslow downstream, the $1.7 billion that they've actually spent on the Onslow downstream, you look at the tolling charge they've got against it, and it was $7.74, which is now inflated to $8.23. They make that for every tonne that goes through their supply chain. So every tonne that goes on their haulage roads, that uses the transshippers to get on the boats, they make $8.23, which is probably actually now close to $8.50, maybe even higher with where inflation's at. That is as good a contract as anywhere in the Pilbara, right, in terms of like infrastructure type charge. And so, you know, the market still insisted on valuing their mining service business as a whole at 5 to 6x EBITDA. We would suggest that component of their earnings, which is, you know, $300 million at 35 million tonnes, but actually if it gets to 50 or 60 million tonnes of fully expanded project, you're making double that, or you're making, you know, $500 million. It's almost like a toll road, right? And I do believe that there is a process that they're looking at to divest maybe just the haul roads, but components of that downstream to a player that has a lower cost of capital than what Minns has, and maybe you can attract 12x EBITDA or an 8% cap rate to those earnings. You just need to look back a few years ago when APA was bidding for absolutely everything that had a yield attached to it, whether it be, you know, defunct transmission line that was basically bankrupt, or whether it be renewable energy like wind farm projects. Like, you go back a few years ago, there was a real need for infrastructure type assets, and I still feel like the right capital would be attracted to a 35 million tonne per annum tolling charge at $8.23 linked to inflation that could deliver 50 to 60 million tonnes. I think that's an attractive income stream.
So on the theme of consolidation as well, one that you've touched on earlier, you know, Westgold, Spartan, Ramelius, the other big player along with Westgold there. And then you've got the smaller players, Alto, Great Boulder. There's a few others in and around there. I'll disclose straight up that I own a few Spartan, as you've said you do as well, as Westgold.
Yep.
How does that sort of play out there?
Well, I think when we talked about it, money at Diggers and Dealers, was that Spartan was going to get taken over by Westgold. And since then, I spotted Wayne and Simon at the pub at Diggers and I snapped a few photos of them together and started spreading the rumour even more so, mainly amongst my team rather than to the broader market. But I think at the time, the share price for Spartan probably was in the 30s and maybe Westgold was $1.80 at the time. So the value equation looked more reasonable then. I still believe that it is something that would potentially be on the cards at the right price. I know Simon has suggested that maybe he doesn't necessarily want Westgold scrip, but everything has a price. You know, the rumour has been around for a while since, you know, Westgold lobbed the bid for Musgrave and, you know, then Ramilius came in over the top of them, and I know Wayne was on your show. It was suggested to me at the time that, you know, Wayne hadn't canvassed the top shareholders of that company then, and he didn't really want that asset, and his real goal was to get Gascoigne, and which is now Spartan. And
there's a few conspiracies out there.
There's a few conspiracies out there, right? I do believe that this Spartan project is really interesting, hence why I've got it in the portfolio. I mean, never have come out with, you know, further drill hits today. I've had a few people kind of do the back of the envelope, try and speculate how much it could have added. I think, you know, those calculations come out around 200,000 ounces. So if never is a million ounce deposit at 6 to 7 grams per tonne, it starts to get quite meaningful, right? And then if you can add on, you know, I know West Wind's possibly disappointed the market in the fact that, you know, 2 to 3 gram per tonne ore body. But that hit that they had to the north, if you can get kind of 1.5 million ounces at, you know, 5 to 7 grams per tonne, it starts to get really meaningful as a project. And the fact you've already got a mill sitting there.
Yeah, the hits, I think it was Patient Wolf, they called Patient the one Wolf, 1,500 metres away, were, yeah, you know, whatever it was, 20 metres at 10 or something like that.
I think
that.
It was even more. But, yeah, I wish I had the announcement ahead of me. Like people have described to me, oh, the mill's a liability. I go, the mill's a liability? What do you mean the mill's a liability? It's an asset that's sitting there that they can...
4 years old.
They can use when they actually got the ore to actually feed it. And Dalgaranga, you know, can there's still an ore body there, right? So you feed that with some high grade feed from Never Never and Patient Wolf, and you could be producing 150 to 200,000 ounces. And what do you pay for that? I mean, 3x EBITDA seems to be the going rate in the market. So we can still see kind of 60 to 70 cents for Spartan with where we sit here today. Question is, I'm not quite sure, you know, if it's something that Simon and the team takes all the way to development, because we've seen how hard that can be as a single mine company. You just need to look at the likes of Calidus and, you know, the struggles that Orobanda have had in the past. Red 5 before, it's, you know, it's really hard to get these things up and running in this early days. And I know it's a brownfield, and sometimes brownfields can be even harder to spot, seeming like you know what you're doing. I do think the combination of those two assets, because I think Westgold is still only trading on maybe 2.5x EBITDA, and I look forward and maybe Spartan's trading on 3x EBITDA. And I know that's completely conceptual because there's no scoping study or anything. I'm just talking about the numbers that we've looked at in terms of feeding the 2.5 million tonne per annum mill from Never Never plus Dalgaranga, what it actually gives you. And we're thinking 150 to 200,000 ounces, probably at an all-in cost of about $1,800. Maybe even less at all in sustaining cost, you know, when you remove some of the growth capex. And we think the combination of those two assets, if you can get then Westgold plus that to 450, I think it's really attractive. And I think I mentioned to you, even at Diggers, that if that does transpire, I wouldn't be surprised if Westgold acquires Spartan and then Ramilius and Westgold merge and become this 800,000 to 900,000 ounce producer. Because the comps are out there, right? Like you've got Evos and Northern Star on 6x EBITDA, and Westgold, Ramilius, and, you know, Silver Lake have picked up between 2 and 3.5 to 4x. So I think there is that arbitrage opportunity for a large, long life kind of underground miner in Australia, particularly now that Newcrest is, you know, a CDI of Newmont. Northern Star have done what they've done and become a 2 million ounce producer. There's still that void in between. I know Genesis is trying to fill it, and, you know, we believe in Raleigh, we believe in the team there. 300,000 ounces at less than $1,800 an ounce is kind of what we're thinking. But I still feel like Ramilius and Westgold and Silver Lake, there's got to be some kind of combination between those guys. Just makes too much sense to reduce the overheads and kind of consolidate some of the labour force into that one entity.
And to round off on the gold consolidation, you know, the Leonora district has been the talk of consolidation for quite a while. You got Silver Lake, you know, making a bit of a nuisance of themselves, you know, to put it one way, taking up 11% in Red.
Yeah.
I mean, on the other hand, you saw Raleigh scoop up the remainder of Dacian just last week. So it looks like in his eyes it's coming together a bit more now.
Yeah.
You know, everyone that you speak with says it's going to be Raleigh's sooner or later, all around there. How does it sort of play out in your eyes?
Yeah, no, well, like it did feel like that Red's mill, at the very least, was definitely an option that, you know, made sense to Genesis at the right price. Now it's 30 cents, the right price, probably not. I mean, he's almost shown that that's the case.
A billion-dollar market cap for Red is
Yeah, the way they've acquired Dacian and paid a premium just to take out Dacian means that they want to utilise that mill, right? Like, it's pretty obvious that they want to favour their existing ore bodies within Genesis rather than what's existing in Dacian. So what does that mean? They're trying to prioritise Tower Hill and maybe Redcliffe over maybe Jupiter's. Does that mean they move the mill closer towards Gwalia and have the two mills sitting side by side? I've heard that's something that has been considered. The cost of it might be, you know, 50 to 100 mil, maybe. You know, if you think of the amount of tracking distance you're going to save by doing so, it's 80 kilometres, I think, from Tower Hill to where Mount Morgan is at the moment. So maybe that's something that gets considered. But it's certainly kind of, I feel, a reaction to what happened with Red 5 is taking out the rest of Daisy and saying we don't actually need that mill, because they don't. Like, you look at the combination of Ulysses, Admiral, Gwalia, Redcliffe, Tower Hill, even Jupiter's, whatever's left over there. The combination of those ore sources can definitely get you to 350,000 ounces. You know, they're saying 300, we think 350. Just depends on where the mill's located, right? What's the optimal source of how tracking that ore to that mill? So, yeah, I do think that they want Red 5, but only the right price, right? They're not going to pay $1.3 billion now just to have the mill there when they've already got an existing mill that's not being filled.
Yeah, and Australian, he can be quite patient to sort of get the outcome.
I do think the plan has kind of changed at different points along the way. You just need to go back to the diggers presentation, and there was all these, you know, forks along the road, and they went one way when they could have gone the other way. So, you know, maybe they could have acquired Red 5 before they acquired Dacian and backed themselves to be able to turn that mine around. And a shout out to the team at Red 5. They've done a great job to get that thing back and actually generating some cash flow. And, you know, we've been there for parts of the journey. We unfortunately missed it when Silver Lake lobbed the bid. And I think it's interesting what it says about Silver Lake too, to kind of wedge themselves into that situation.
For the first time.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like Luke and I like Len. What is it, Lenny the Landscaper? He's a good bloke. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we will. Let's get into a few of the other sort of individual picks rather than consolidation that you've got out there.
Yeah.
So the one you've kicked around a little bit is Piedmont Lithium. And now this is one we've hardly spoken about.
Flirting with Piedmont.
we've hardly spoken about it. It's It flies very much under the radar. Kind of to your point on Mins earlier, there's a lot going on, you know.
They've got it's complex.
NAL, they've got, you know, the ownership in Ghana, they've got the various projects in Carolina and Tennessee. So what's the sort of idea that's coming together in your mind here?
So Piedmont is one that we identified really early. So if I didn't go through our whole process, and I'll try and give you the 1 minute spill rather than the half an hour chat about how we actually select stocks. What we do is when we identify a theme, such as electric vehicles, we then go do a body of work and like literally model up all the companies that we can find that are associated with that theme. So I did the lithium work back in 2017, and literally identified all the lithium stocks that we thought were investable for us at the time and had models on all of them and went, which are the companies we want exposure to from a valuation standpoint and then quality of resource, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time, Piedmont was on the list. Like Piedmont's Carolina asset was around then, and it was one of the only assets in North America from a hard rock perspective. It was pretty like Quebec going crazy like it has now. And at the time, we thought, you know, Piedmont was really interesting for the fact that it was literally the only spodumene mine in North America, only spodumene resource, sorry, not in North America, in USA specifically. And we thought the provenance was going to become a bigger factor within the investment landscape. And I think we ended up taking our first position when they did a capital raise probably in 2018. And I think from memory, it was around 11 cents. And we sat on that position for about 2 years. And this is kind of how we think about those emerging names. We try and find what we believe are strategic assets that we think the value will get realised over time. And 2 years later, I believe we sold our position probably the peak that we sold it was 45 cents, but maybe average exit of 35 to 40. So we'd literally 4x'd from our initial position at the final sale point, Piedmont Lithium, and that was when Tesla came in. And so being associated with Tesla at the time meant your project was verified and all of a sudden you were a real project. It went from this piddly smaller company to being verified by Tesla and got all this fanfare. We weren't smart enough to ride it all the way because it got to a dollar and we were just like, geez, I can't believe the hype that came along with Piedmont. And then we almost kind of shelved the idea from back into 2020 for a couple of years. And during that time, Piedmont actually changed its stripes. You know, they invested 25% into NAL with Sayona and took on that offtake. They took their position with Atlantic and invested 50% in their Warrior project in Ghana, and then they switched kind of almost to upstream focus, downstream focus, which I didn't quite, I still don't know, necessarily agree with. And so I re-engaged with Piedmont, I'm going to say 12 months ago. I caught up with them at a conference and was like, geez, what's going on with this whole diversified portfolio of stuff you got? And he's like, oh, no one cares about what we do anymore. No one understands the story. It's not, you know, there's not too many people listening to us. And we were probably still a smaller fund at the time, and I was able to get a one-on-one with them, and I wasn't able to get one-on-ones with a lot of other companies. And I'm having the background with Keith and understanding everything that went by, I was like, explain this contract to me. And he was like, oh, the NAL contract. Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I go, no, explain it to me. It's like, so Piedmont literally takes half of NAL's mine, as long as it's producing, they get half or 113,000 tonnes, the higher of the two, and they get to do it at $900 a tonne US. And it took me a while to actually understand what that all that meant, but it's $900 a tonne US, no matter in 10 years' time inflation has done to costs or whatever, it's $900 a tonne US, so it's not indexed. I sat down and went, Keith, that is almost the best lithium contract in the market. Well, it is the best lithium contract in the market, particularly from a buyer's perspective. Because at the time, I think when I was sitting down with him, lithium prices, we'd seen him, you know, rocket to $4,000 a ton. He's buying his spot at $900 a ton for 113,000 tons. And I went, that's going to be worth a fair bit, right?
It gets better and better over time, right?
As inflation gets higher and higher. So I think I said to you before when we started, or before the cameras were rolling, I think Pilbara at the moment is maybe $530 a ton Aussie, and you know, that's after tantalum credits, and you know, that's, but you add on royalties, you add on shipping costs, you add on your stay in business, and the all-in cost of that might be $600 a ton US. And I'm picking a number because I can't calculate it on top of my head, but most of the other spodumene mines in the world would not have a cost structure where your all-in cost, including stay in business, royalties and everything else, is $900 a ton US. Whereas that's what Piedmont literally gets to buy 113,000 tons per annum from Sayona for the life of that mine. Now, obviously, we've spoken about it. Sayona needs to still be operating. That mine needs to be producing that spodumene for Piedmont to get its share of it. But if it does keep operating, that for me is an unbelievable contract, and there's so much value within that contract. So if I step back from Piedmont today, and I think today when I was looking, its market cap was probably $900, $950. It owns stakes in both Atlantic and Sayona. I think it owns something like 12% of Sayona,
and 9%
of Atlantic, and it's got maybe $100 million US in cash. So its EV today might be something like $700 million Australian. They own, it was 50%, but it's now 40.5% of the Iwoya project in Ghana. Atlantic's market cap is equating to $300 million for that 40.5% stake. Now, Piedmont has to fund some of that JV, and there's a few other funky things with Atlantic, including the Ghanaian Sovereign Wealth Fund investing in Atlantic. But let's just say $300 million for their 40.5% stake in Iwoya as well for Piedmont before that expenditure. So for $400 million, that's what you're left over after, you know, the EV and after you take out the value of Iwoya implied by Atlantic. You're getting that contract over NAL, you're getting 25% of NAL, you're getting 40 million tonnes resource in Carolina, which could be worth $1 billion in its own right. You're getting a hydroxide plant, which is almost fully permitted in Tennessee, which has a $200 million IRA grant across it. And you're getting this stake in this new position in Newfoundland. So
there's a tax benefit with that IRA grant as well, right, for the hydroxide facility.
So let me go into each of those different components that you're getting for $400 million. So you look at that contract that they've got with Sayona, and let's theorise that mine stays open for its life, right? Let's not assume it shuts down, because that is a risk. I appreciate that is a risk. Stays open, you're getting 113,000 tonnes at $900 a tonne for the life of that contract, not indexed to inflation. At the moment, we said at the spodumene price, I don't know which index I'm supposed to be looking at, but let's call it $2,100. So you're making $1,200 a tonne on 113,000 tonnes once it's fully ramped up. Now, I appreciate that this thing might take a little bit longer to ramp up than others expect. That's fine. I'm prepared to be patient because they've got $100 million cash and they've got a lot of other options. But say you're generating $120 million US, which equates to about $180 million Aussie. Now, Pilbara at the moment trades on a 6x EV to EBITDA. You put $180 million at 6x EV to EBITDA, it's about $1 billion. And that's similar to what I get from my DCF of that contract. So $1 billion. If you look at it another way, in my mind, it's actually a royalty. Like you're not taking operating risk as Piedmont by having that contract. You are effectively just getting a revenue stream. The difference between what the spodumene price is and $900 a tonne at any point in time, it's a royalty stream. It's effective income of a royalty. Now, if I think about a company like Deterra Royalties, they trade, I think, at EV to EBITDA about 11 times and Fortescue trades at 5 to 6 times. So in iron ore, the most obvious example where I can tell you how much a royalty is worth versus an operating mine, it's worth double what an operating mine is. So without getting too carried away, if you apply double the EV to EBITDA to, you know, Pilbara example and said this offtake royalty could actually be worth double what I'm assessing it at $1 billion, could actually be worth $2 billion. This is Aussie dollar terms. You're paying $400 million for Piedmont for this contract, which could be worth between $1 and $2 billion Aussie plus. So I'm super excited by that. And then you go, well, Carolina, we were buying Piedmont originally for that Carolina asset. It's going through the permitting process and the Gaston County, you go in and you read some of the stuff that's been written about it, it's quite negative, right? But every time a permitting project goes through this process, all we hear is the negative stuff. I'm not saying it's a fait accompli that this project gets permitted, but you know, the Carolina spodumene tin belt is the original mining region for spodumene in the US, and Kings Mountain, as far as I understand, has been permitted, and that's just up the road. So there is a chance that this mine does get permitted, and in my mind, 40 million tonnes, right on the doorstep of the US, quite an attractive cost structure. I remember Premier used to come around and tell me this was super attractive, like just you need to look at the cost of labour, the cost of all the materials. Like I know the strip ratio is probably 8 to 1, so it's a little bit higher on the strip ratio, but the cost structure of that mine is like super exciting. I don't think there's any royalties that they've got to pay. I don't think there were any. I think they've agreed to pay some, but you look at that could be worth $1 billion. You know, 25% stake in NAL could be worth a couple of $100 million. You know, like their share of the hydroxide plant in Tennessee, I actually don't think there's much value in downstream anymore. Like I really do feel like the value within the supply chain is with the rock, and being, you know, a Chris Ellison fanboy, I would say that. But I think that, you know, they've got a $200 million IRA grant against that hydroxide plant. And I think within the next month or two, we should see some news around that. And maybe LG might be considering kind of becoming a joint venture partner on that. So I think we'll see a transaction transpire where the downstream, you'll get a partner come into that project, and hopefully it means that Piedmont don't have to put any capital into it, because I just don't think the value is there from a company like Piedmont's perspective to be in the downstream. But looking at the combination of all these things, and I'm sitting back from my valuation going, if NAL continues to operate over its life, I do think that Piedmont's probably worth $1.40 and it's trading at 48 cents today. So you're almost like 2x, you know, 200% from where it is today, which, you know.
You're flirting with the idea.
I'm flirting with it. And yet I know I've done a fair bit of work, but it is a bit of a flirt.
So what leads to pulling the trigger?
I think it's getting comfort on, I think it's probably seeing the cash flow that's being generated from NAL. It's seeing that. It's understanding where their cash flow lies today. It's also getting comfort that they're not going to spend the money on the downstream. So there's a few factors there. And I do believe that there's a process going on at the moment where Keith is speaking to a number of people in the market around downstream at Tennessee. And I want to definitively see that they're not going to be spending a large lick of capital on the downstream, because me as a shareholder, I just don't think that with where their cost of capital is, I just don't think it justifies them spending a material amount of their equity in the downstream. I just want to see them focus on the upstream resources that they've got. So it's getting comfort that the capital is not get it allocated to the wrong investments, and then it's going really hard.
There's one more company I want to touch on. That's IMDEX, and you've sort of described this in the past as a sort of picks and shovel way of playing the sort of upcoming boom that we're going to have. So, I mean, to start with, give a bit of context why you think IMDEX as opposed to the various other mining services businesses out there is a preferable one.
Yeah, I think, look, I think all the mining services companies are actually pretty cheap. Like, so I'm gonna say, like, shout out to all the guys who have been doing it tough. They're getting no love from the investment community because there's a few of those companies that are literally trading at 60% of book value. So I think it's pretty interesting, right? I don't think the market appreciates how tough it has been to get labor into those mine sites and, you know, the kind of work that these guys are doing. So I do believe that, you know, as a whole, like, mining services businesses are probably underappreciated as a whole. But then IMDEX in general, it's like, for us, the technology benefits that they're providing, I think, become more and more important as mines get harder and harder to develop. And I think that you look at what they've got with their gyros. So, like, something like 60% of their revenue comes from the gyros that go into the drill bit, right? Like, you need the gyros to understand what you're doing underground and for the drilling. And I believe that they've got this unique IP within having those gyros and their position within a mine site versus, you know, just having a crew of guys that are doing the digging and doing the drilling. And I believe the upside from their business from having that technology advantage, or at least that incumbent position on a number of mine sites, where they're making the driller's life easier, they're providing the information back to the drillers in real time rather than having to go off to an asset lab for all of the information that needs to be collected. So I believe in the opportunity that's there for IMDEX. I believe that BlastDog provides this massive amount of optionality without going into the huge amount of detail around BlastDog. Basically, BlastDog is like a probe that you put underground when you fragment the rock, and it helps you determine where the best sources of ore are going to be and helps you optimize getting the right ore into the right point within the ROM pad.
Minimize the dilution.
Minimizing the dilution, correct. I do believe, like, the IP that they've put into that, it could be something super exciting. It could also go to nothing, right? There's other people that are working on a similar technology. But if you've read what we've written about IMDEX, like, if BlastDog works, the upside case is like $7 a share, and today IMDEX is trading at $1.50. Now, the other aspect of IMDEX that I think is really interesting, like, we try not to play the macro, right? Whenever we identify a trend or we identify a theme in the market that we think the market is underappreciating, then we get super excited. So when we first wrote about IMDEX, I think it was early 2021, we could identify this situation where everyone we were speaking to in WA was telling us that they were starting to see, I guess, the early onset of an exploration upswing. And the market was so negative. It was like COVID, no one's spending any money, nothing's occurring. And you saw that reflected in the revenue expectations for both IMDEX and ALQ. And I kind of started doing the digging. I started going, well, hang on a sec. What does an exploration up cycle look like? It looks like a 3 to 5 year type of boom swing. And it looks like you compound during those periods, you know, between 20 and 40%. And so I just looked through past cycles and went, this is what it's historically looked like. And it has been pretty cyclical over time. And I was starting to speak to these drillers, and I was starting to speak to people in the industry and starting to see the early signs that there was a beat coming. I'm like, well, let's extrapolate that further and actually go, well, hang on a sec. I believe we're at the start of a full-blown cycle, and you can pick your reason why, but gold prices were stronger. The energy transition is starting to happen. You know, commodity prices like copper were starting to run. And all the drillers were saying that they're starting to see, you know, everything transpiring. Capital raises were coming through, and people had just made a lot of money under Gray and Chalice. It was straight up the year after they just had like 2,000% increases. And we're going, geez, we could be at the start of an exploration up cycle here. I think what happens in markets is that people overcapitalize and undercapitalize during peaks and troughs of a cycle. So we took that insight and went, based on our observation of the exploration cycle and how we're seeing things, we believe the revenue that IMDEX can deliver can be something like 20% above the market on a two-year basis, and same with ALQ. And when that happens, you get the operating leverage because their cost base is somewhat fixed, and then your margins expand. And fortunately for us, so the next kind of two reporting cycles, it played out like exactly how we hoped, and it worked out to be an insight. Now we're almost facing the complete opposite situation, where we came out in January this year and we said S&P are projecting exploration expenditure is going to be down between 10 and 20% in 2023. And yet the market for IMDEX had like revenue pretty flat. And this is before Devico. They made this big acquisition around Devico. And we went, well, what does that actually mean? Like, it actually meant to us, and we actually put in the paper, that we could see that there were going to be downgrades coming. We thought that BlastDog might be somewhat able to offset some of those downgrades, and they came out in May and admitted the fact that BlastDog wasn't taken up as quickly as what they'd hoped and what we'd hoped, which was disappointing. But we could see that market was going to have to downgrade. But all that aside is people are getting caught up in 1 year of what we believe has to be a longer term uptrend cycle. So we're having a down year in what we believe could be another 3 to 5 year cycle. If you look back in 2012, 2013, exploration expenditure got to $20 billion. Last year, it was about $13 billion. And by the 10 to 20% down, it meant it was going to be $11 and a bit billion in 2023. And I think at the moment, it's looking like it's going to be $12.5 billion. So we're still yet to see what it comes out at. But then on the other side of it, S&P are now saying the start of 24 is going to be soft. Or it's going to be, stable. So we're not going to see any pickup at the start of 2024, which is fine. It just means that basically financial year 24, how we're looking at the data means it's going to be a flat to down, maybe slightly up type of financial year for the likes of Index and the Explorers. Now, that's fine, but you go back to the energy transition and everything that has to occur for us to get to a point of EV penetration at 70% in the next 20 years. There needs to be 380 lithium, cobalt and graphite mines that come into production by 2035. And that's not my number, that's benchmark minerals. And I don't want to steal sources because people do that to me all the time. They copy my work and they never quote it. So that's benchmark minerals. But if that's to occur, all the exploration needs to occur at the front end. There's a massive correlation between the amount of mining capex and the amount of exploration that needs to occur. And we all know that a massive amount of mining capex needs to occur for the energy transition to occur. But what might be underappreciated is the amount of exploration that needs to occur to enable that capex to occur. So I completely see the data and what S&P is saying. So financial year 24 will be soft. But that means Index might have, pretty flat revenue from an organic standpoint in financial year 24. That's fine. I think the market's now there and I think it's been reflected in the negativity of share prices. I think people are kind of extrapolating that, then it's not going to grow again. But I would say in financial year 25 and beyond that, we need to enter another period of explosive growth and exploration expenditure. And I believe that at some point we need to get back above that $20 billion, which is a real number from from financial year 2012. We actually need to get, $26 or $27 billion, if you think about nominal terms, what inflation has done, just to satisfy the need for the energy transition. So if you look at, I was looking at it at my desk before, the revenue for Index growth in financial year 25 versus 24 is only 4%. Now, whether or not it's 25 or 26, I think the market's only got a similar level of growth in 26. At some point within the next 3 years, I believe you're going to need a period where exploration expenditure is up another 30% and you're going to get another massive spurt in the exploration cycle. And it's not necessarily been reflected in consensus projections and hence the price of Index as we sit here today. So we're super excited about it. Particularly when people extrapolate things that what we perceive to be kind of a low point in a cycle. And I feel like the lithium's in a similar space. I feel like when we did the work on, if you read our work on Origin is another massive example. Like we were looking at the energy markets business. This is like 2 years ago now going, geez, things have just troughed. And it was like the perfect storm of like electricity prices going up when you set your tariffs at the start of the year at a low point in the cycle because of COVID. And it created this position where energy markets were earning like $0 per megawatt hour and historically they'd earn $25 a megawatt hour. And we just went, geez, if that normalizes and you look kind of 2 to 3 years out and it's normalized to $25 a megawatt hour, the market is completely extrapolating the wrong level of earnings 2 to 3 years out. And we think Origin can be worth $6 to $7 a share, right? And we're buying this thing at 80% of book value and no one in the market wanted to speak about it. And now they get, they get the bid from Brookfield and everyone wants to try and squeeze Brookfield for more because, Origin's not, it's worth more than $9 and no one wants to buy it at $4 or whatever it is. And it's like people always over-extrapolate things when things are going well and just when things aren't going so well, just extrapolate too much down the bottom.
Yeah, and perhaps the Index thesis ties in with another one of yours around the, small to medium caps, trading at a significant discount over the past 5 years or so to how the large caps have gone. And maybe the reversion to the mean there ties in with more capital coming in. Anthony, we'd like to finish with an underrated, overrated section and I wouldn't let you off the hook without one. So one word answers, underrated, overrated, or if you're not familiar, we can pass.
And what happens if I'm tempted to say more than one word answer? Are you going to hold me up on it or are you?
I will hold you up on it.
Okay. All right, okay. One word let's answers. Go. Yeah.
Stanmore Coal.
Underrated.
Coronado.
I'll go neutral.
Copper.
Hard to give a one word answer on this. And I know I said one word answer.
Okay. I'll preface with over the next two financial years.
Oh yeah, underrated, but that's consensus. So I'm not, yeah. When you say if everyone thinks it's going to go up, and I believe that too, what's my?
Well, I feel every fund manager has said, you know, copper's going to the moon, so yeah, well, perhaps that would have been overrated.
Possibly.
Alrighty, Sandfire.
Oh, let's say neutral.
29 metals.
Neutral.
Employment data as a sort of, you know, means of, you know, weight and equities and those sorts of things.
Oh, overrated.
Bellevue.
Oh, I'm going to go, oh, it's a tough one. I really like the team there and I really like what they've done, but valuation versus peers, let's just say neutral, but I love Gleeson. I can't be dismissing Gleeson on Australo. So
yeah. Okay, all right.
And Bill's doing such an amazing job underground. So yeah.
We'll see how they go over the next coming, you know, half year. It'll be telling. Yep. De Grey.
I hate to have so many neutrals, but what I'll say about De Grey is I still don't believe the CapEx. I still don't believe 1.3 is the right number. So I think 500,000 ounces, the cost structure is going to be higher. Like the all-in cost is going to be higher. If they'd come out and said $2 billion in CapEx, all-in sustaining costs, $1,300 an ounce, I'd say 100% believe it, underrated. But I still think we need to see CapEx higher than where it is and all-in sustaining costs higher. So, yeah, I'm going to sit on the fence on that one again.
It sounds like you said overrated there, but we won't say it.
Oh, it's very hard to say overrated. I like a lot of these teams and there's elements of De Grey that I really like, but, yeah, the CapEx needs to be higher.
Okay, this one you can say sort of bullish or bearish. Chinese economic growth.
Oh, I'm going to say bearish, yeah.
Gold Road.
Ooh. Oh, I like – this is one of our favourite gold stocks of all. Like we've been there in the past. It's a simple ore body. Yeah, I like it. I like it, but it's everything's got a price, right? So I want to say underrated, but well, I'm not a buyer at this price.
Okay. Yeah. Atlantic Lithium ties in with your Piedmont.
Yeah. To be honest, even though it ties in with our Piedmont and I'm using it to justify the valuation of Piedmont, one of the things that we've made mistakes in the past is like large exposures to Africa. Now, for Piedmont, it represents a small exposure, so I'm willing to flirt with Piedmont, as I said. But as 100% exposed, I just don't want to be waking up with a Leo Lithium situation in Ghana. And everyone tells me Ghana's different and they've got the history of the gold mining there and, you know, it's got a much higher, you know, sustainability rating and et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's value there. But, yeah, let's say neutral.
All right. So
you have a good draw me into too many buyers and overrated, but,
yeah. Tying that one
hopefully
out.
Hopefully in sense.
The sort of thread in that one that I want to touch on, West Africa as a jurisdiction.
Yeah, so we try not to invest in West Africa, and if we do, it's usually when it's a small component of the overall company, and that's because in the past, I know it's East Africa, we've invested in Syrah, and I know Syrah's having a great day today. That's one of the ones where we kind of, like, we were really early in the EV thematic before lithium became a big thing, and I was almost obsessed about Syrah in terms of, like, I just love the thematic. I love learning about it. But it's another one of those lessons you learn that just because it's a great thematic doesn't mean you'll make money on it. And one of the key facets that I kind of learned from was just African exposure with that. And I've seen a lot of companies since then. I mean, I know you covered Leo and Firefinch on your show. You got to invest there with one eye wide open. And I had a smaller position in Leo Lithium earlier this year, and this is like a story of fortuitous timing, but one of the directors sold $2 million worth of stock. And I said, I think earlier when we were talking, that I don't necessarily use that as a definitive, you have to sell a stock because the director sold some stock, but I went, that's a material amount. And I'm already kind of breaking a rule by having a thing about Leo Lithium because it's in Africa. I just went, that's enough for me. And I sold out at, I think, $1.03 or something like that in the fund, small position we had. And the whole time I was cursing when it went to $1.30, just thinking, oh, everyone's still going to keep buying it. What am I doing? And then, like, I slept so well when it went into that trading halt, like, a few weeks later. I just went, yeah, nah, I shouldn't have even flirted with the idea of investing in a company that's materially in Africa. Simon, I really like Simon. I've been speaking with Simon for quite a while. the grade is great, the ore body's great, strip ratio is low. So on paper, you know, if that mine is in, you know, Canada or WA, it's worth a lot more. You know, and that's I do like Patriot as a result. And Azure is really interesting too, right? Yeah.
So another one you mentioned that I actually had on the list as well was Syrah, underrated, overrated.
Syrah's like an ex-girlfriend of mine. And so you never go back to your ex-girlfriends. and so, look, someone's going to make a lot.
It sounds like you're saying overrated.
No, I'm not actually saying overrated. Someone's going to make a lot of money on Syrah. And it, like, maybe I'm kind of breaking one of our own rules that it's unappreciated and loved, but even I can't go there because we've been there in the past and been bitten. Today's news is part of the thesis that, like, it is a China-dominated commodity, and that creates both opportunities and risks. The risk being that you don't actually have visibility on how much supply there is in the market. And we made a similar mistake with Cobalt and Jervois, and, you know, I like to be open about our mistakes because you learn a lot from them. And I do feel like eventually graphite will have its time in the sun, and maybe today's the start of that. Maybe it's still a couple of years away. I mean, there's still campaign mining. Like, when the world decides that, yes, we're going to back this, even though there is supply coming from China, let's back Syrah because we've got a downstream facility to take all that flake and actually, you know, turn it into a spheronized graphite, that's when Syrah will have its time and sun. And my view, and I appreciated that at the time capital was constrained, was always they needed to have a spheronization plant to sell the flake into. And because of the capital constraints they always had, they're always butting up against like having to sell the flake into a market when the market was depressed. And my viewpoint was always, no, I want to see that downstream facility taking the majority of your flake, whether it costs you $300 million to invest in the downstream facility or whatever it is, get that facility up and running so that you can spheronize all that and then you're selling the finished product, which is kind of where a lot of the other, you know, lithium companies got to eventually just going, well, we want to control our own destiny and let's have exposure to the hydroxide facilities that we're selling our spot into. My view was always that Syrah needed to be in control of its own destiny by selling the final spheronized product. And for one reason or another, they weren't able to do that, whether it be capital, whether it be the ability to get the right sized spheronization plant. Do I say overrated? No. Let's say it's an opportunity. So it's underrated, but not for us.
Okay. Another one that tied in with your Piedmont, Sayona.
Yeah. Overrated. Overrated 8 cents. Like, I want them to keep going. You know, I want them to stay around. So please fund NAL. The economic rent of that mine, but Moblin, so Moblin's really interesting. So you've got to separate NAL from Moblin. Moblin does look like it's really interesting. Maybe it's 60 million tonnes at, you know, 1.3%, 1.4%. I do think that there's a whole bunch of projects in Quebec, which that's going to be super exciting, right? The whole Patriot, Winsome, Moblin story is super exciting. It's the only spodumene mine that's actually operating in Quebec that I'm aware of at the moment. I think the economic rent is going to Piedmont. Like, they're taking 50% of it at $900 a ton, which they're obviously not. That's below where their costs are actually sitting at the moment. So Piedmont is effectively buying spodumene cheaper than they can actually produce it for. So they're taking the economic rent and basically pocketing the upside between $900 a ton and what the spodumene price is. Overrated. These would not be one-word answers.
All right, last but not least, one word, Lynas, underrated, overrated?
Underrated. Amanda's another gun. I love Amanda. So that was my one word. What I would say, though, is Ironiclase. Like, I'm a believer in Ironiclase. I've seen the economics.
Meteoric.
I think Meteoric is one of the answers. You just need to look at the feasibility studies from the hard rock guys, like the Hastings of the world, and see that they probably need $90 a kilogram for NdPr to actually work. I've seen the economics of what Meteoric can deliver from, you know, you look at what recoveries they've got, what grades they've got, and maybe it is very early. We haven't yet seen a scoping study. But you look at what IXR are putting out there and kind of apply some of the metrics of what they're suggesting to what Meteoric has, what some of the other ionic rare earths have in Brazil. And I do believe, like, I don't think I've ever seen such a such a game changer in terms of like position on the cost curve. Maybe the last time I saw something similar was shale in the US when it first came into being, when, you know, Canadian tar sands were the marginal price setter, and then all of a sudden shale completely changed how we all thought about oil cost curves. That is kind of how I'm thinking about Ionic clays, and we still need to do a fair bit of work to understand it. But yeah, I believe in Ionic clays over hard rock. But Linus has the incumbency of already being into production.
Beautiful. Anthony, I always learn heaps talking with you. Thanks for coming on Money of Mine.
Thanks, mate. No, I really appreciate it, JD, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely.
Thanks, mate.
There we go, mate. Part one and part two of Anthony Kavanagh on Money of Mine, done and dusted.
How good was that? That was awesome. I love just listening to Anthony. He, in terms of the amount of insight per minute of content listened, I actually think he might have set a new record on Money of Mine.
Yeah. There's not a wasted sort of minute. You're just digesting information constantly with him, and, you know, a pretty broad range of topics in the, you know, almost 2 hours that we spoke for. And I mean, I've had it every time I've spoken with Anthony. It's awesome. You always take away so much, and, you know, this was no exception by any means.
I love the fact that you talked about you talked to him for 2 hours, but you only asked half the questions you went there with, and that's just bloody hilarious. I can't wait to hear you talk to him about the other half of the questions that you had prepared next time you're in Melbourne.
It'd gone about 2 hours. I was worried I was running over time with him, but when we pulled up stumps, he was like, oh, we're done. So I'd only got through about half the questions, but, you know, there's plenty of uncharted territory for us to get into next time. And, you know, I'm pretty confident the Money Miners will enjoy that one, because there's just so much to take away from somebody who's so passionate about markets.
If you're still listening and you're in Sydney, come to the Criterion Hotel tonight. We're keen as to meet you and sink beers with you. And, mate, buddy, let's round out with thanks to the sponsors. That was Terra Capital and Cadrill at the top of the show, Future Proof Consulting, brand new, KCA, brand new. We've also got JP Search, Anytime, Exploration, and SMEC.
Awesome. Thanks a bunch, guys.
Hoodaroo.
Hoodaroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation, and needs.